Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Friday, the 27th of March. Today, MI5 is to be investigated by the police over claims that it was involved in the torture of a Briton held at Guantanamo Bay.
Certainly in modern times, it is unprecedented that you're going to get a particular MI5 off on a particular case on pretty specific allegations being investigated by the police.
Also today, Gordon Brown tries to put his differences with his Chancellor and Bank of England Governor behind him as he prepares for next week's G20 summit.
Maybe the meeting with President Luna is important. Much of the rest of the trip really looks like a symbol of action. I'm not sure the action is actually going to be there.
And New Labour's Alan Clark, Chris Mullin MP, on his diaries chronicling life as a junior minister in Tony Blair's government.
18 months in the environment, in the vast Department of Environment, Transport and the regions tended to be a cascade of all the many things that one's superiors didn't wish to do.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, Bill Overton with the news headlines and the papers.
At least 50 people have been killed in Indonesia after a dam burst. A 10-foot high wave crashed into a district in the capital, Jakarta, submerging hundreds of houses. Rescuers are using rubber boats to help victims. Indonesian television has shown pictures of bodies floating along with the debris from homes. An eyewitness has described it as a flash flood. The kidnappers of five Britons held in Iraq for over a year say they'll release one of their hostages. The Guardian's been told that a statement from the kidnappers says they've made a deal to free one British man in exchange for the release of 10 detainees being held by the Iraqi government. They're members of a Shia militant group, including a former spokesman for the cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. It's expected the man to be released will be Peter Moore, the computer consultant. In the United States, Barack Obama will announce his new strategy for Afghanistan later. He'll move the focus onto more support for Afghan troops and will send 4,000 extra US soldiers specifically to train Afghan forces. The US plans to help nearly double the size of the Afghan army from 80 to more than 130,000. President Obama wants to involve the neighbouring countries of Russia, India, China and Iran in his policy for Afghanistan, and his special envoy will tour the region for consultations every 2 months. Gordon Brown's opened discussions with Buckingham Palace about how to change the rules for succession to the throne. Downing Street sources have told The Guardian the Prime Minister suggests ending what he calls an anomaly, a ban on Catholics marrying into the royal family. It's expected that a monarch would go on having to be Protestant. Another change being discussed is to allow an older daughter to take precedence over a son in the succession. Gordon Brown himself is now travelling to Chile on his tour of three continents leading up to next week's G20 meeting in London. In Brazil, he called for a $100 billion fund to be put together by the summit members to spend on reviving world trade. But he was forced to talk more about his own forthcoming budget after warnings that Britain couldn't afford any further government spending to stimulate the economy. He promised to be cautious with public finances. The Guardian puts the possible freeing of an Iraqi hostage on its front page. The Independent and The Times choose Afghanistan, while The Telegraph and The Mail go with the changes at the palace. A revolution at the palace, writes The Mail, concentrating on an older sister being allowed to take the throne. Royals could marry Catholics, is what The Telegraph thinks is most important. The Independent lead headline reads, Obama's exit strategy for Afghanistan. The paper reckons the president will vow to end the so-called drift in the war and try to take a stronger lead in the intervention. It says that along with more troops, he plans a civilian surge. The Times has been talking to the head of the army, Sir Richard Dannett. He tells the paper that he's also poised for Afghanistan's surge. He's ready to send another 2,000 British troops to the country. The two main red tops go their own way entirely this morning. The Sun reports that Chelsea and England football captain John Terry's mum has been arrested for shoplifting. It says that she and a friend were cautioned after being stopped at chain stores in Surrey. The Mirror reckons that its news is truly sensational, that Robbie Williams is ready to rejoin Take That after 14 years apart. Perhaps he's been spurred on by the news this week that Spandau Ballet are getting back together. More news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
The police are to investigate claims that MI5 officers were complicit in the interrogation and torture of the former Guantanamo Bay detainee Binyam Mohamed. Mr. Mohamed alleges that when he was held and tortured at a secret site in Morocco following his arrest in Pakistan in 2002, an MI5 officer supplied questions to his interrogators. Richard Norton Taylor is our security editor. He told me what the police will be investigating.
The answer is that Scotland Yard, the Metropolitan Police, say they don't know yet. There's a possibility that it may not be the specialist operations or the counter-terrorism people or the people who are normally dealing with spies and so on, i.e. the sort of serious specialist operations people in the Met. There may be even another police force, partly because, and it hasn't been decided yet, but it could be because of the implications that MI5 work very closely with the Met police on terrorism and all, you know, spies and alleged spies and all sorts of things, serious organised crime. So it may be put out to a non-metropolitan police force, such as a sensitivity and controversial nature, really, of this investigation.
A very unusual investigation.
I think it's unprecedented, probably. I think, you know, obviously the police have investigated people in the past, in the Cold War, who have been accused of being double agents and Soviet spies and so on. I think also just after the war in Germany, some interrogators were arrested for being too brutal to suspect or Nazi or German suspects. But certainly in modern times, it is unprecedented that you're going to get MI5, a particular MI5 officer on a particular case on pretty specific allegations being investigated by the police on the instructions of the Attorney General and the Director of Public Prosecutions.
Speaking in Brazil yesterday, Gordon Brown repeated his insistence that this government does not tolerate or endorse torture. How will we know whether the government and security services aren't cooperating with the police?
I mean, the issue really on this is, you know, the government may say, you know, our policy is we don't condone torture. Ministers may say that, and that's certainly the official policy. But what actually happens on the ground is another question. And especially after 9/11, from 2001 onwards, there's enough evidence, including admissions actually, by MI5 and MI6 officers, and indeed military intelligence officers in the army, that they did not know enough about interrogation, about Geneva Conventions, about the law, international law, torture convention, how wide that is. Under pressure, they were also under pressure from Americans who know what the Bush administration wanted, you know, forget about the Geneva Convention, that's a quaint thing, as some of the Bush people said. And so there was tremendous pressure on MI5 and MI6 officers abroad, for example, in Pakistan or in Afghanistan, and they asked London, some of them asked London, you know, what do we do? Is this allowed? Is hooding allowed? Is this X, Y, and Z allowed? Plus the pressure from the CIA, and you get people, the evidence, you get people, the individual officer, saying that doing something which is basically, on the face of it, illegal, and collusion, and colluding with torture. And one of the, Binyam Mohamed told The Guardian that after the, you know, Lady Scotland, the Attorney General, announced this police inquiry, that he didn't want Officer B, as he's called, the MI5 officer who interrogated him, and who's the target of this particular investigation, to be made a scapegoat. Because he and others, indeed, in campaigning groups and human rights groups, and the leader of the opposition, David Cameron, and other people, say there should be a broader inquiry into, you know, who, the Officer B, why was he doing this? Was he telling his bosses and all that? He has said in evidence to, in the High Court, Officer B has, that he was just following what he thought was policy sanctioned from on high.
Richard Norton Taylor, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/Guantanamo Bay. Also on The Guardian's website today, Chris McGreal says farewell to Africa. He looks back at 25 years covering the continent as our foreign correspondent, guardian.co.uk/G2. The Guardian's critic Peter Bradshaw reviews The Damned United, a reenactment of Brian Clough's tempestuous 6 weeks in charge of Leeds United. Peter Bradshaw says it's a richly enjoyable, expertly constructed and effortlessly acted film starring Michael Sheen giving what I think is the best performance of his big screen career. Read the rest of Peter's review at guardian.co.uk/film. And Marina Hyde marvels at Simon Cowell, who was apparently too busy to meet Barack Obama. guardian.co.uk/lost in showbiz. Gordon Brown arrives in Chile today on his Whistle Stop World Tour, a prelude to next week's G20 meeting. But his attempts to look statesmanlike have been overshadowed by a rift with his Chancellor, Alistair Darling, and the Governor of the Bank of England, Mervyn King. Julian Glover is our chief leader writer. I asked him what his reading was of Gordon Brown's apparent retreat on demands for a further fiscal stimulus in next month's budget.
Well, he's been under a lot of pressure because the money is beginning to run out. It hasn't really completely run out yet, as the Tories and perhaps Vince Cable gave the impression in question time on Wednesday. But he's under pressure. He doesn't have a lot of cash to spend. The debt is very big. And if he thinks the answer to fixing the economy is to spend a lot more money, There's a lot of people now telling him he just can't do that, and that is difficult for him.
He said there are three ways in which the government's trying to mend the economy. One is the fiscal stimulus, and the other two, on which he's now putting a bit more emphasis, are quantitative easing and the lowering of interest rates.
Yes, I mean, interest rates can't really go any lower. If you want to borrow money, if you're allowed to have a loan, if the banks will give it to you, it's very cheap. People with mortgages that are flexible, it's very cheap. Quantitative easing is putting more cash into the economy. So the whole Brown solution, to the extent that there is yet a solution, is really to just to put lots of money into the economy in the hope it'll begin to catch fire, that cash will just start sloshing around, things will begin to grow, people will go shopping, companies will make more stuff, stock market goes up, the economy goes back to normal. The worry is that actually more cash won't matter. What we would need is confidence. And the Tory argument is that putting cash in, cutting bills, cutting interest rates, doesn't really work anymore because people are too scared to spend. And they say the way to restore confidence is to tackle the debt. And that's the bit where the confidence has really got in trouble this week.
How serious was the disagreement, or the apparent disagreement, between Gordon Brown and Alistair Darling and Mervyn King?
Well, journalists like writing about splits. So as soon as we could find a split to talk about, we certainly honed in on it this week. And I think there is a disagreement. I mean, I don't know how serious it is. I don't sit in the room. I don't think it's at the scale of past chancellors and prime ministers who've fallen out much more spectacularly, Thatcher and Lawson, by the end. We've often had chancellors even resigning. I think we're nowhere near that. So we shouldn't overdo the Darling-Brown thing. I think Darling is being cautious. That's the job of the Treasury. Prime Minister wants to spend money. That's often what prime ministers want to do. There's always that tension. There's also the tension with Mervyn King, who's the governor of the Bank of England. A lot of that's personal. He doesn't like Gordon Brown. Gordon Brown doesn't like him. They don't really speak to each other, it seems. Possibly not at all. Certainly not very often. And when they do, it's a bit edgy. There's probably a bit of a disagreement on policy too, but we have to be a bit careful about declaring this the end of the world week. There's a lot of those yet to come.
Next week, of course, it's the G20 summit, this tour that Brown is on at the moment. Today he's in Chile is a sort of curtain raiser for that. He's trying to build support. How successful has his tour been?
I think the whole thing's completely mad. I can't understand what Gordon Brown's doing, jetting around the world, all sorts of things that don't really add up into one coherent message. Certainly political terms in Britain it doesn't work. I think the public would just think, why has he gone away? Everything's going wrong at home and he's dodging Prime Minister's questions. Gordon Brown would say, little concerns of Britain, really the thing that matters is the world. I've got to see people to get this global deal next week, and to get a deal you have to have a meeting beforehand because you can't really agree it all in a day. People from offices in London have been out around the world working on this already. He's seeing President Lula in Brazil. He's going to Chile for one of those progressive governance conferences that Tony Blair and Peter Mandelson always used to love. And in the back of all of those, he'll chat away and hope to reach a bit closer to a deal for next week. That's the theory. I just wonder really what going to New York, very tired, crawling out of a British Airways plane, going to the Wall Street Journal of all places, and having a chat with Robert Thompson, who used to be the editor of the Times, on a webcast. He could have done that from London. Has somebody not explained that the internet is a thing that you don't need to travel anymore? Going to a university in New York? Maybe the meeting with President Lula is important. Much of the rest of the trip really looks like a symbol of action. I'm not sure the action's actually going to be there.
And what's the best Gordon Brown can now hope for from G20?
I think he can probably get quite a lot. I mean, one thing I hope is that he'll get some sleep before it, because if this manic schedule continues, he's not going to be at his best. Then I think there are some chances. I mean, the basic argument is that it can't fail because nobody dares come out of the G20 and say they haven't agreed, because that would be pretty embarrassing, possibly calamitous for the world markets. So he'll get some sort of deal. Question is, what does it do? Well, the negotiation on that will go much, much longer after the G20 meeting. Nobody expects one day in East London to solve the world. But he might get an agreement on the sort of financial response people want to the crisis. So the governor of the Bank of England doesn't even like the one that Gordon Brown wants, so can we expect the world to agree? He'll also get a bit of agreement on trying to regulate markets, but it'll all be very technical.
And are his hands tied now because he isn't able to offer the other world leaders a fiscal stimulus in the UK?
Well, his hands are a bit tied because our position's worse than other people's, and yet he seems to think he can lecture other people on what to do. I find that a bit implausible. He obviously doesn't. He thinks he is giving good guidance. And perhaps in October last year, he really did. He led the way on banks ahead of America. Some things that Britain's doing now, America is doing later as well. Issuing more money seems to be a British thing that America's copying. So he can say he's leading the way. But I think if you look at the British numbers, they're just much worse. We're in a deeper hole. We have a bigger deficit. We have probably a sharper recession. And that's going to hit us very heavily. And whether he can then say to the world, look, we're getting it right, when the world thinks we got it wrong in the first place, I'm not sure.
Julian Glover, I'm John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, what makes a gay icon? The National Portrait Gallery has attempted to find out.
The gay icon is the people that have that mean something to these 10 gay selectors.
But first, Delith Morgan, the Minister for Children and Young People, says drug and alcohol misuse among children is falling. But new research by Professor Martin Plant from the University of the West of England shows that the problem is worse in the UK than in most other European nations. Our Consumer Affairs editor, Rebecca Smithers, has the details.
The survey shows that in Britain, we have a huge problem with teenage binge drinking, and we've actually been ranked the third worst country in Europe on that measure. And girls actually are more likely to be abusing alcohol than boys, which is really rather shocking.
Well, that is shocking, because it used to be socially unacceptable for females to drink too much.
Well, it's quite extraordinary that I think it's a combination of special offers that supermarkets are offering girls, you know, very, very cheap cheap deals. It seems to be some social changes. I mean, certainly in my day, it was not the done thing to be a girl and going out and getting bladdered.
And, you know, why should the UK be worse than other countries? Because the only ones that are worse than us, you say we were third, but the only ones that were worse were, I think, Bulgaria and the Isle of Man. So, I mean, you know, we're right up there. Why is the UK particularly bad?
We do seem to have a problem with particularly cheap with cheap alcohol through these special offers from supermarkets. And, I mean, the difficulty with that, of course, is that younger children of this age, 15 and 16-year-old, technically speaking, shouldn't be buying alcohol anyway. So I think it's down to lack of guidance from parents. There is a section in the research which shows that about a quarter of these kids got no direction or guidance from their parents whatsoever. So they're really going out and doing their own thing.
And alcohol problems, of course, lead to other problems.
Well, that's all. This is also very much in the news, because what this shows is that although teenagers in the UK are buying and drinking alcohol because it has positive associations, it makes them feel cool, it gives them confidence, but at the same time they're very vulnerable to things like teenage pregnancy, because they're often having unprotected sex, they're risking trouble with the police, they're bunking off school. So there's a whole range of related problems which are all caused by this excessive drinking at a very young age.
What about smoking and cannabis use? Because they're also covered in this survey.
Yes, I mean, it's interesting that with smoking, and I suppose it's part of the general trend in this country, smoking levels have gone down and the number of teenage smokers in the UK has fallen since 1999. But of all the drugs that these teenagers are taking, cannabis is by far the most popular. And only about 11% of British teenagers admitted that they smoked cannabis in the last month. But you could still say, well, even 11% of 15, 16-year-olds is maybe you know, too much. And there's also a bit of glue sniffing goes on, and that seems to be something that the girls prefer to the, you know, rather than the boys. Yeah.
What about government policies? I mean, are existing policies having any effect on curbing drinking
habits?
Well,
I mean, this is a hugely controversial area, very, very topical at the moment, because we just had some new guidelines produced by the Advertising Standards Authority, and although they're promising the biggest shake-up of advertising for 50 years, interestingly, they've decided to leave the advertising rules governing the sale and promotion of alcohol well alone, because they seem to think that what we have in place at the moment is kind of cast iron enough. But the issue about whether alcohol is too cheap, that's something that keeps raising its head for the government. There's a feeling, really, that we should be raising the tax on alcohol, make it more expensive, and just putting it out of these people's reach. And that in turn is controversial, because the government's line is that that way we would be penalising, you know, a large sector of the public who actually are drinking moderately and sensibly. So why should they have to pay more?
Rebecca Smithers. In a former life, Chris Mullin was a campaigning journalist who helped prove the innocence of the Birmingham Six and the author of the novel A Very British Coup. Well, for more than 20 years, he's been Labour MP for Sunderland South, and now he's published A View from the Foothills, his diaries covering the period 1999 to 2005 when he served as a minister in Tony Blair's government. He says his actual power as Under-Secretary for Folding Deck Chairs was minuscule. But Mullin says that failed politicians make the best diarists. I asked him why that was.
Well, I think they've got less to justify. I mean, it's a light-hearted comment. I wouldn't want to make too much of it. But if you look at the people whose diaries have been most successful, they've been people who occupied the lower or at the very most middle ranks. Chip Shannon in the 1930s, a Conservative MP, never rose higher than parliamentary private secretary to the deputy foreign minister, and yet, well, what he did, of course, he married into the Guinness family and entertained on an awesome scale. The king comes to dinner in the middle of the abdication crisis. I can't match that, of course. And then Alan Clark really was from the lower reaches, although he probably would deny it. He didn't occupy one of the top posts in government. And the other example is Jock Colville, who was private secretary to Churchill, not a politician. He wrote a very good diary, which was published, I don't know, 20 years ago. But none of those people, all among the most successful diarists, occupied top jobs.
You spent 2 years working for John Prescott as an environment minister. And during that time, your opinion of him changed. You said at one point that under that volcanic exterior, there lurks a decent human being.
Yes, I worked for Prescott for 18 months, and it was a kind of white-knuckle ride. It was a vast department with about eight ministers, of which Prescott, the Deputy Prime Minister, was at the top. And we'd have ministerial meetings, which tended to be a sort of stream of consciousness about whatever had hit him on the way into work this morning. So my first impressions weren't very favourable, but I began to notice after a while that, firstly, he's got very good political antennae. Secondly, he's very loyal to colleagues and a man of his word. And thirdly, on several occasions, let me give you an example. One of the political advisers once circulated some brief on Archie Norman, who was Prescott's opposite number on the Tory side, who was a businessman. And it was all about Archie's financial interests and so forth. Prescott just thrust it aside and said, I'm not having anything to do with that. It demeans politics. So you could see there was a decent streak in him. He was also very successful in screwing money out of the Treasury for transport. I think he got more out of it than any of his predecessors.
You weren't in the stratosphere. You describe yourself as the undersecretary for folding deck chairs. But nevertheless, you were quite important as a minister. And one of the things that you get quite stressed about in reading these diary entries is that when you're called upon to talk about things about which you know next to nothing, which does sound a very stressful situation to be in.
Yeah, I had three ministerial posts. The third one, which was as the Africa Minister in the Foreign Office, was wonderful. I was a round peg in a round hole. But as I said, 18 months in the environment, in the vast Department of Environment, Transport and the Regions tended to be a cascade of all the many things that one's superiors didn't wish to do. So, for example, an invitation when I'd been there a few weeks was passed down to me from Nick Rainsford's office, and it still had the private secretary's note appended to it, and it said, this is very low priority. I suggest we pass it to Mr. Mullin. So I wrote no on it in large letters and waited to see what would happen. And as I anticipated, within minutes, someone was in my office explaining why it was really of the highest priority. And there was a constant stream of invitations to address conferences, often of experts, 200 people about coastal erosion. The speech would be thrust into your hand on the morning of the event. Often it would be full of impenetrable jargon, which I did my best to delete. And then the terrible moment after you delivered it would come when the chairman would say, and the minister has time to answer a few questions. Well, it could get a bit scary.
You refer to Tony Blair throughout the book as the man. I'm curious to know, is that a term that just you had for him, or was that shared by your colleagues?
Well, I think after I'd been using it for a few months, several of my colleagues started using it as well. It was a very, as has often been remarked upon, he was very definitely in charge, and it was a very prime minister-centred government, and he was the man, and that's how I referred to him. And as I say, it caught on after a while.
Chris Mullin, and you can listen to a longer version of that interview today at guardian.co.uk/audio. And A View from the Foothills, the Diaries of Chris Mullin, is published by Profile Books. A quick mention that at twitter.com/guardiandaily, you can follow how we're putting together the podcast, twitter.com/guardiandaily. Gay icons are the subject of a new exhibition of photographs at London's National Portrait Gallery. The gallery's asked some prominent lesbians and gay men, including Billie Jean King and Elton John, to select 60 portraits. The sitters include Quentin Crisp, Joe Orton and Daphne du Maurier. Pim Baxter is the National Portrait Gallery's Deputy Director.
It's an exhibition that's been chosen by 10 selectors, and the selectors themselves are gay. And they've selected 6 icons who mean something to them or have influenced their life, or, you know, that they've been particularly impressed with in their life. So, and they're all photographic images. So there's a huge range of people. I mean, there's, you know, you've got people like Will Young, you've got Harvey Milk, Lily Savage, Nelson Mandela, Peter Tatchell, then people like Rostropovich, the cellist, Althea Gibson, the tennis player. So as you can see by what I'm saying, there's quite a range of people who the visitors will see when they come to the exhibition.
What makes a gay icon?
Well, I think in this instance, and obviously the title's quite intriguing, but in this instance, the gay icon is the people that mean something to these 10 gay selectors. So it's, in a way, it's their icons. And I mean, a lot of the people that they've chosen could also be other people's icons, because I mean, when you look at the list of individuals that are in the exhibition, you know, there are, I mean, for example, Nelson Mandela is kind of an icon to so many people, but, you know, was particularly chosen by the selector, Billie Jean King.
Possibly a surprise inclusion.
What, Mandela?
Yeah.
Yes, but what we said to the selectors was that the person that they choose does not necessarily have to be gay. So, I mean, a number of the selectors have chosen gay people as their icon, but others haven't.
This is the first portrait exhibition to celebrate gay icons and the contribution of gay people to history and culture. That seems remarkable, really.
Well, yes, I mean, I suppose it is, but then I think, you know, I think times have moved on. I don't think that this possibly is not an exhibition that one would have done, I don't know, say 20 years ago. I think what's been great is the involvement of the selectors, because Sandy Toksvig, who's one of the selectors, has chaired the selection panel. And, you know, we've chosen a range of people who, as politicians, as writers, as actors. And I think the cross-section of selectors also reflects the very interesting people that are in the exhibition itself.
Why did the gallery decide to limit the choices to photographic portraits?
Well, we thought, I mean, we did talk quite a bit about this at the beginning, but, you know, as with everything, when you're planning an exhibition, you have to kind of think about what is practical. And if you're asking, you know, 10 people to choose 6 people themselves, that becomes quite a big thing to do. And we decided actually we would focus it on photographic, because that also kind of focuses it into a time span as well, because that's sort of within the last 150 years. And, you know, a lot of the people that have been chosen, you know, I think photographic images lends itself very well to this kind of exhibition. And also because it gives the exhibition another layer as well, because in amongst the selectors and the sitters, you've also got amazing photographs, because you've got people in there like, you know, Snowden, Beaton, you know, Linda McCartney's got pictures in there, Fergus Greer. So you're also getting a level of very good photography as well.
Pim Baxter and Gay Icons is at the National Portrait Gallery from the 2nd of July. Today's podcast was produced by Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. My name's John Dennis. Thanks for listening.